is Charlie Harper from the UK Subs over in London, England, saying hello, Vancouver, on CITR 101.9 FM. Don't stop listening. Support your local radio.
Good morning. I am Farha Khan. This is Prof Talk. Kathleen Wythe is my guest today. She's a writer from Vancouver and a graduate of the UBC MFA Creative Writing Program. Her debut novel, Having Faith in the Polar Girls Prison, was just released last Thursday. It is set against the stark and haunting landscape of Canada's far north. 15-year-old Trista chronicles the events of her life from her room in the Polar Girls Prison. Caught in the decline of sexual abuse, drunkenness, and failed motherhood, Trista tries to make sense of her past, especially the events that led her to jail. With heartfelt compassion and rare insight, the stunning new voice of debut novelist Kathleen Wythe lends light to the hardships and suffering of the teenage girls in Clash of Cultures in this remote region that has never before been represented in literature. You are listening to Prof Talk. First, I want to say congratulations on the release of your new novel, Having Faith in the Polar Girls Prison. How does it feel to have published your first novel?
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, you know, after quite a bit of time writing and doing the literary journal thing and going back to school, it's amazing realization. I just got the book in the mail I cried at my mailbox. Just all those great things of holding it in your hand and seeing it come to fruition.
Now, how long has this novel been in the works?
Well, it actually started, I had gotten into the MFA department, creative writing up at UBC, and it started as a short story in Keith Millard's class. And it was him, he's an amazing teacher, and he just said, you know what, I think this sounds like a novel, and that's all he said, and I had just been writing short fiction, and, you know, when you take a lot of workshop classes, short fiction, it's more conducive to school, and I never really thought about writing a novel-length piece, and with his help and with the other people in the workshop, I just kept going. I just kept hearing the main character's voice, Trista's voice, and it pretty much finished itself at the end of the creative writing, my MFA.
So it was almost, was it like a thesis in a way? Was that your final project, or was this something that you were doing?
Well, it's funny because through, I also took a children's literature class with Alison Atchison, which was amazing as well, and through both of those classes, I thought it was going to be my thesis, but it wasn't done. There was just so much more research I needed to go back to, things I needed to think about, and so I ended up pulling together short stories for a book that came out 2006 with Arsenal Pulp Press called Skids, and I ended up submitting that for my thesis because a lot of the stories had been, you know, polished and pretty much finished. I added some new ones and so that I could spend a little bit more time working on the novel.
Right. Now, what is Having Faith in the Polar Girls Prison about?
Well, it's about a young girl who's come from, you know, struggling to make herself her own life. And I'd lived up north for 2 years in the Mackenzie Delta region. I lived up in Inuvik and taught a lot of girls that had lives similar to Trista's. And she's trying to, you know, coming out of abuse and addictions and a home life that her mom dies when she's at an early age. And, you know, she has some uncles, quote, uncles that are dodgy. And she just wants to, at, you know, the ripe old age, she thinks, of 14, 15, she wants to make a life for herself and have, she gets pregnant with her boyfriend and have this baby and have this baby turn out and do it right and how she sees it should be done. Be a good mother, you know, have a healthy relationship, have a place to live. And what happens is there's one night where, you know, she fights with Tyler. Everything is not the dream, and her boyfriend takes off. And during that week, she falls back into some bad habits, and something happens, something that changes the course of everything. And so she's telling her story while she's in prison, and we find out what has happened to her, and she goes back into the past and what has sustained her as well and is going to sustain her with now her little baby who's mentally disabled.
Mm-hmm. Now, what inspired you to create, you know, the character of Trista, or, you know, the story of her life?
Well, I think I've always been moved by first-person voice, because I think it was neat when you were interviewing Keith Millard about how he hears the voices. It sounds kind of mystical, airy-fairy, but I do too. I it's like I hear this character's voice in my head, and it's like there's this story that needs to be told. And for me, it was working with these kids up north that, it, you know, especially the girls, it was such a different thing from teenagers, what we call down south, you know, in Vancouver or in Victoria, where, you know, if they got pregnant, it was kind of a, you know, when are you going to go get the abortion? When are you, or if you're going to have it, how is that going to work out? And are you going to give it up for adoption? But really, it was more, no, I'm probably going to go get an abortion if I'm 14 and pregnant or 15. Whereas up north, a lot of the girls, I would say about six of my students at the time, they were having the babies. And I mean, they were either giving them to their older sisters or aunties, mm-hmm. or having them and saying, you know, I want to be that young mother and try to do it differently. And that intrigued me, that sense of, you know, they wanted something to love them, that there was such a disconnect maybe in their childhoods. Now, of course, Trista's fiction and Jackfish Bay is fiction. It's just outside of Inuvik, because in Inuvik, there are a lot of good things that are happening as well to help the youth, but there are also a lot of problems with addictions and young pregnancies. And there's also some of my students, you know, would have the baby, and then the baby died of SIDS. So, okay. You know, after all this preparation, that happened to two of my students, suddenly the baby was gone. And, you know, they were dealing with depression and... I just admired them so much, because the two that this happened to, they would just come to school every day. I mean, they would just keep trying. And for me, I was just fascinated at their will to go on against all these odds, like, you know, death on the ice road and drownings and you know, kids driving their skidoo or kids dying from overdose. Or it just seemed that every month something bad was happening. Mm-hmm. So that kind of propelled the story, that feeling of how do you have hope, how do you have faith against all these seemingly insurmountable things. And, you know, I myself had problems in my youth and had a good, you know, working class upbringing in Richmond, and yet when I was a teenager, things happened and I still struggled. I struggled with addictions, I struggled with depression, I struggled to you know, lift up my head, and I had a bad bout with, it sounds kind of funny now when I think about it, but I had a bad bout with mononucleosis, and I got quite depressed and sick from it. And for me, I mean, I had, you know, there were hospitals, there were counselors, there were people to help me, and I had school as well, and yet it was still a struggle. And then seeing these girls or these kids having to deal with it without that much support, I mean, I just, was fascinating, and I admired them. And so that was part of it, that fascination about how do you have this hope? How do you keep going with this little baby who has so many troubles and could possibly be, you know, have fetal alcohol syndrome, and you know, you're a young mom and you have all your own issues. How do you just keep going and learn to love, learn to keep things simple and stay alive?
Now, the story of Trista, her story is written from her room in the Polder Girls prison. So she's actually in jail,
right.
And you tell the story of her life. How did you get inspired to create a story from that setting?
Well, there is it's her words that it's a prison, because actually it's a youth facility, but she feels incarcerated, and there is a real life facility in the town of Inuvik for girls. And the bizarre thing is that, you know, it's just kind of 5 minutes from the main town, and that's for Jackfish Bay. That's what this facility is like, the Polar Girls Prison is like, that a lot of the girls are coming from outside the region. Trista just happens to be close by, that she's from close by, and that they're coming from, you know, Politic or Tuktoyaktuk or possibly even Inuvik, possibly even Yellowknife. One of the girls comes from Yellowknife to get away from, ironically, the big city of, wow, 17,000 people, to try to get some help. For me, I wasn't as young as Trista, but I was in detox when I was 21 and went to a treatment center and afterwards. And that whole kind of being away from friends, being away from the city and trying to work on problems, trying to get up and get off drugs and do chores and do some group therapy and even do schooling. I didn't do schooling there, but I looked into college courses. It was a fascinating thing, and it was a very, its own little world. And I think that played a lot into Trista's world of how do you, in a short time, try to figure out your life and let people in, trust people enough to talk about what's going on, try to figure out what's going on, and try to turn the life around. So that the prison itself, you know, she thought she was doing this with Tyler in their little home before this bad thing happened, but she wasn't really. So in a way, the prison becomes the home for a while, and the group home in a way, if you will, and she learns to connect with people, the therapist and her daughter, still with this fear of, well, her daughter's going to be taken away. She only has these 2 months, and she needs to get, you know, excuse my French, but her shit together, because what's going to happen? Is she going to have to go to Yellowknife? She doesn't even know the outcome of her court case. So she's in a kind of a remand / treatment center youth facility situation with her little baby.
Can you describe Inuvik and also the ice road, which is a common theme in your novel?
Sure.
And set it in terms of its geography and where the novel is placed.
Right, right. So I lived up there for 2 years, and it was very interesting, because Inuvik was it's a created town. It actually came out of A clavic is a place that's still there, but would experience a lot of flooding, and still does. And so what happened in the 1960s is the government and also the military, actually, because they had the early defense warning line up at Inuvik, created the town. And it was on a bit higher ground. It's still very close to the Mackenzie River, the east channel of the Mackenzie River, because this area is the Mackenzie Delta, so there's all these little windy roads, and once the ice road sets in about November, December, actually it was late December this year, it's changing with the climate change, you can drive to Iqaluit, and you can drive from, you can take the Dempster Highway from Dawson City, which is the most northerly highway, and then when the ice road gets in, that's the most northerly highway driving the ice road to Tuktoyaktuk in the world. Aside from, I think there's one in Alaska, but it's privately owned or military owned. And so this was, of course, fascinating because when I lived up there, my first apartment I lived in, I could see out to the ice road, and it was very bizarre seeing these cars, you know, their headlights on going up and down this river. And it plays into the novel a lot because it's a main route for, you know, starting in December, we have a cutoff time till the Mackenzie River freezes, where we really only have frozen vegetables. You know, we're waiting for this guy called the Fruit Man, we call him, and he comes up in his rig from Vancouver, and I think there was even a Discovery Channel show on him, and we're so excited because he brings all this fresh fruit, and we just, he opens up the back of his rig, and we walk in and buy all this fruit and stuff, and I mean, everything's so expensive, you get to like UHF, you know, like that Tetra Pak milk, and you learn to make different things with frozen foods and stuff, so it's cut off, but then it's not cut off. I mean, Inuvik has flights to Yellowknife and Edmonton every day, and it's known as kind of the hub of the Mackenzie Delta region, and it wasn't uncommon to hear L.A., I mean, I think the first week I was there, I heard, you know, kids with portable stereos running around with that 50 Cent song, and I just come from L.A., so it was a little bit bizarre to hear this L.A. rap music or, you know, American rap music and the snow and the everybody in these big parkas and stuff. It's also it's almost a desert. If it hadn't been for the Mackenzie coming up there, and we still have a bit of the tree line, it's very dry, and it doesn't snow that much. So when it does snow in September, that snow just stays there till late May, early June, and you know, you get temperatures upwards of minus 45, but it was still strange because I could still walk to school as long as I was dressed properly. And sometimes it was colder down in Vancouver at, you know, a minus 3 than it was in Inuvik at minus 33. So that was interesting as well. Mm. And so I mostly lived in Inuvik and around the Mackenzie Delta. I had driven a little bit with friends, but we also drove up to Tuktoyaktuk because when the ice road's in, that's the end of the road. I didn't see much of Tuk because we hit I was driving up with a bunch of kids. We were doing a drama, actually. We were going to do a drama for the war on Iraq and present it to the high school up in Tuk. And we were in the middle of a blizzard, and we basically got to the school, and our driver said, yeah, we're probably going to have to go back today, or you're going to be in Tuk for 3 or 4 days. And here I had, you know, 8 kids and 2 volunteers, and we couldn't afford to do that. And so we ended up driving back home to Inuvik, and, you know, the driver's saying to me, keep your eye on the road because it's easy to go off the road and, you know, we'll just freeze here. And so, of course, I was scared. But the kids weren't. They were doing their Game Boy and, you know, laughing and listening to music, and it was all just fun and games for them. So the region is it's gorgeous, beautiful. I mean, the Northern Lights and with the ice road as well, but it's also got that edge of tragedy and, you know, raw nature. It's not unusual to go for a walk on this kind of route where we take the bypass. It was the one road where the trucks would go up. And we would do this kind of route and walk sort of 6 kilometers once the weather got a little bit nicer. And to see a bear just ambling by. And you know, for me, I was raised in the city, and I'd been in Seoul also for many years. And yeah, that was kind of confronting nature. So that was very exciting and impressionable for me as well.
Now, your novel is one of the first novels from that region in the world. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, there's art coming out of there, for sure. I mean, they have the Great Northern Arts Festival, which is a great festival in the summer, and artists also come down to Inuvik from Holman and Sax Harbor to participate in the Great Northern Arts Festival. There are writers, Gwich'in writers. Robert Alexi is one of the famous writers from the area. But there's not much contemporary fiction. There's a woman named Alice French, and she wrote a book called My Name is Massac, which I mention in the book as it was her story, coming from McClavick and having to go to the residential schools. And we teach it in the curriculum up north. But other than that, there's not writing about the kids and what they're experiencing right now, which, you know, is definitely, this novel really isn't about the residential school, but it definitely has the overtures of that, you know, probably a lot of the reasons that Trista has these problems is because a great generation was destroyed and taken away and hurt by the things that had gone on. And Inuvik itself had, you know, one of the so-called sort of halls, I think it was called Greylick Hall, and, you know, just even in Alice French's novel, there wasn't a great amount of sexual abuse like a lot of people had experienced, but just the getting your hair cut, getting slapped for speaking your language, being away from the family for so long, not learning the ways, because in this area, the Inuvialuit people is the subgroup. They would travel a lot, you know, back in the day. And it's also a little bit scary because it's that culture, the Inuvialuit culture, is our fastest, we're losing that culture the fastest. I think there's only 150 speakers. At the school I worked at, we did have a class where they taught Inuvialuktun, the language. But the kids, you know, their parents didn't know it. Some of their grandparents still didn't know it. And so that culture is being lost, is in danger of being lost. So that was part of it for me as well, that all this stuff was going on with these kids, and it wasn't really talked about. I mean, in the Eastern Arctic, of course, this stuff happens as well, and certainly in reserves across Canada. But this was a strange little mix-up in the Mackenzie Delta because, you know, oil-rich, I mean, these kids weren't really poor. There was the Inuvialuit Regional Corporation is quite rich. They have, you know, talks of the Mackenzie Pipeline and that going in. Plus, the Gwich'in lived there as well, and they had self-treated in the 80s. And then there were a lot of white people that had come in from the 60s on, or even with the army, and also with the educational or social services or hospital up there. So there's lots of money in the area. I mean, that's what the great irony is, and yet there's still kids falling through the cracks or getting involved in the drugs and alcohol that's in town and the social problems. So it's very different from the Eastern Arctic, and I think one of my things too was that I've been to Iqaluit, and I didn't want to I wanted to focus on that the Inuit of the Arctic can't be generalized. It's very different. The Western Arctic is very different from the Eastern Arctic.
Would you like to do a reading of the novel?
Okay, so this is from right in the beginning, the first bit of the book. So it's right at the start. It's early morning, and Faith is fussing again. Hardly got the sleep out of my eyes. I tell the worker that comes in that sometimes Faith can't get her mouth to seal around my nipple. She leans over us both, gently smooths her finger over Faith's upper lip. Faith flutters her little lashes like she's trying to wake up more, and I shift her closer to my nipple. The worker reminds me that preemies get tired easily from the sucking and maybe too used to the bottles. She looks at me like she's going to say something more, but then she goes and leaves us alone. Faith is snuffling a bit against my breast, starting to latch on, and I feel relieved she's finally sucking proper. I'm thinking this is the best feeling ever. Makes all the outside shit go away. The other girls in here, some of the staff looking at me with needles in their eyes. I never know who's related to that woman from the Aurora store. I mean, in Jackfish Bay, everyone is related to everyone. Hell, I think even I was related to her. Through the sliver of a window I got in here, I can see some of the ice road down the hill. The white headlights of one or two cars making their way north to Tuck or maybe south to Inuvik. hook up with the Dempster Highway and away from here. The ice road's not just one road. You got the oxbows of the East Channel going to Tuck and out to the Arctic Sea, then a windy road going west to Iqaluit. Lots of kettle lakes and channels connect up. And though maintenance rigs patrol it, with sensors even to check the ice, still, a blizzard come up and it's easy to go off the road. Or just get lost in the loneliness of the dark and the ice. Let the green ghosties of the northern lights come dancing, lead you astray. Even though it's early morning, there's no bit of light anywhere near the ice road. Sun won't really touch our town until January. Just some dusky skies around noon, sun squeezed up for a little peak, maybe 11 a.m., then right back down to shine on them in the south. November and dark days here in the Mackenzie Delta. Saturdays are sometimes bad. Even though I get to spend the day with Faith and not have to give her to the workers while they make me go into the classroom, learn my language arts and math, I still got to spend the whole day thinking about Tyler, what he's doing down there in Yellowknife, if he's thinking about Faith or me. Would he even have wanted us once she got born and her being the way she is? Some workers say even foster care can't take her. She's so retarded. Don't think Auntie or Nanik come to take her. Been here 3 weeks now, and they're not coming to see me. Too ashamed. Only Keely been to see me. And the Snow Nanics are too old and almost gone out of their house, most of them at the Elder Hospital. If Faith could have the Snow Nanics, who looked after all us kids, maybe things could be okay. Simple and sweet, like when we was real little. Me and my best friend Keely, we dreamed of being like them when we grown, like they all good and looked out for their little ones, and then their kids' little ones, us coming from the back roads of Jackfish Bay. The Snow Nanics always had their door unlocked and something hot to drink on the stove. Maybe they won't let me in now, what I done, where I'd going, and maybe for life. No one to look after Faithy now, maybe just strangers. Mom would have taken her if she'd been here. Mom would have taken her right up, not scared of any retarded kids, not my mom. But that ice road taken her long ago. That worker says maybe I got 2 more months with Faith in here, then they're thinking about what to do with her. On a good day, when the snow is flaking down soft, and I'm in my small room watching it flutter onto the scrub trees, some kids zipping by on skidoos, can see the flash of their faces under the facility lights, their cheeks red and chafed, mouths open and laughing. Me and Faith inside warm, and Faith at my breast, sucking proper. I think of her, all normal future, running to her new mom. Her hair in pigtails, her feet have on the beaded slippers Nanik sent her, and me watching her on the webcam here. Don't know how long they're keeping me inside for what I done. I forget all the good I keep trying to remember, how we're calling all our grandmothers Nanik and trying to get some old spirits talking to me in here. Like Nanik says to me, Trista, remember your Snow Nanics, we all who are loving you. Remember the good they learned in you. Who's going to save me and Faith but those northern spirits long gone? Who's going to look after me, quarter Eskimo, three-quarter rig pig, and who knows what else, and my fucked-up baby? Faith starts to gurgle a bit, this hum she makes when she's done feeding. I swear, she's looking at me with those dreamy eyes, lips pushed together with her tiny mouth humming, and I put her up to my shoulder, pat her bum. Her hand brushes against my Ulu necklace, the one Mom gave me when I was 5. Then the red light goes on, and the bell goes off, and my door snicks open, free from its electric lock.
That was Kathleen Witt, a graduate of the UBC Creative Writing Program. Listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM. We will be back next week at our new time slot every Monday at 7:30 a.m. Dean of Applied Science, Dr. Abul Nasser, will be my guest next week talking about her recent appointment to the faculty, as well as her research in electrical engineering in the area of digital signal processing. If you would like to send feedback of this show, you can email us at proftalk@gmail.com. Or for an updated schedule of future shows, you can visit our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. And you can hear the podcast of this show anytime on citr.ca. I am Farha Khan. Thank you for listening.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!